You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Friday edition of the Pronk Pop Show. This is a redo of the Friday show, and let me explain. I had finished more than an hour, I think it was an hour and a 40-minute show, and we found out in post-production that we had a recording problem. And I won't bore you with the details, but there was no way to really go in and fix that recording problem. So we're going to have to really redo the show, which I'm redoing today. And I'll try to condense it down to an hour, because I'm rather pressed for time. I have to not only do this show, I have to do my Monday show. So I'm going to try to keep it brief to the point, and at least under an hour, probably 40 minutes, 50 minutes. Usually your commercial radio shows are 42 minutes, 43, 44 minutes because they have commercial breaks at both the top of the hour, bottom of the hour of 6 minutes each, as well as at the quarter hours of 2 to 3 minutes. So this show will definitely be a solid hour show, but might only run about 40 to 50 minutes. Now, what did I try to zero in on? On my Friday show, the administration, the Obama administration, both the Secretary of State John Kerry, the National Security Advisor Susan Rice, have been asked several times by the press, are we at war with the Islamic State? On several occasions, they have emphatically said no. They don't want to call it a war. What term do they use? A sustained counter-terrorist campaign or a sustained counter-terrorist operation. And they're quick to emphasize, and I'll get to this on Monday, that this will be a broad coalition. A broad coalition. I hope so, because the only way you're ever going to degrade and defeat the Islamic State is on the ground. Air attacks will take their toll, but there's a problem. And the problem is they're treating this as a terrorist campaign. This isn't what's called an insurgency. An insurgency is where you have a group of people, a fighting force that's trying to overthrow a government, in this case, two governments, the governments of Iraq and the government in Syria, the Assad regime, Bashar Assad regime. Now, why is this important? Yes, they use terrorist tactics. No one is denying that. But terrorism is really in the eye of the beholder. And what do I mean by that? We have been using drones to kill people all over the world, mainly in Yemen, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan. And we use them because there's no pilot on board. There is a pilot in a base that's operating the drones. And where we have good, solid intelligence, we usually kill the person we're after. But there's a problem. It's called collateral damage or friendly fire, where we actually kill innocent people. In other words, we thought we had good intelligence, but oops, sorry, we made a mistake, and we just wiped out your family, your relatives, your neighbors. We were just a little bit off. We had some bad information. Sorry about that. What's the problem with that? And this has been going on across the world, mainly in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. And now Iraq. You never hear about the killing of innocent people. But we're doing that every day. The United States is doing that. Now, to the people on the ground, that's terrifying. They're in fear of these drones. because many more friendly, not friendly is the wrong word, many people that are not involved at all in terrorism, whether they be Iraqi citizens, Yemen citizens, Pakistanis, Afghanistan, people of Afghanistan, are killed. And what does that lead to? It leads to more and more and more people being recruited to our enemies. Because really, to conduct a good drone attack, you're only good as the intelligence you have. And that's the problem. That is a big problem. And yes, they say they're very careful as to who they target. That all may be true. But once those missiles are released, they have a mind of their own, even though they're supposedly laser-guided and guided in. You might be driving down the road, and they mistake you for one of the terrorists and blows up your car and your family in it. That's the problem with the so-called technology, the remote control technology, and relying on intelligence that may or may not be accurate. Most Americans, including me, have no problem using drones if, with a high confidence, I mean over 95%, you can guarantee the person you're targeting is the one that's actually hit by the missile. But many times it simply isn't. Now let me get back to the Islamic State. They have an estimated, and no one knows the exact number. I don't know the number. I'm just giving you what I'm hearing in the press, and it's from various intelligence agencies, including the Central Intelligence Agency, as to the size of the Islamic State forces. On the low side, 10 to 15,000. On the high side, 50,000. It's probably somewhere in the middle. And in terms of the true believers that are hardcore, probably 5 to 10,000 tops. So it's not a small force. That's fairly large. It's at least the equivalent of 2 to 3 U.S. divisions, maybe even 4, in terms of number of people. And they have a lot of combat experience. Not all of them, but they have a lot of experienced fighters that have been fighting in Syria against the Assad regime, as well as in Iraq against the so-called Iraqi army that turned tail, took off the uniforms and fled. So you have, and I've described them and other people have described them, the Islamic State forces are what most military experts would be called a light infantry. In other words, they're very, very mobile. But they really, and that's important because they can, if you ever look at a map of Iraq, your cities and towns are usually along the main highway. So if you control the main highways, and they do in the northern Iraq and northern western, well, let me explain for those that are not familiar with the map of Iraq. In southern and eastern Iraq, it's primarily Shiites. And in southern Iraq, especially in the Basra area, that's where the oil is. Huge oil fields. Now, you do have some oil fields around Baghdad. That's sort of central Iraq. And what you need to understand about Baghdad, it's very much mixed neighborhoods of both Sunni and Shiites or Shia. And then you have northeastern Iraq, which has three Kurdistan provinces where there is some oil in the Kirkuk area and the Mosul area. So you have the Kurds in the northeast, and then you have north and eastern Iraq, predominantly Sunni Muslims, and there are estimates between in Iraq in terms of the population. Iraq has a population of roughly 33 million, of which 6 to 7 million are Sunnis. The majority are Shia. And again, you're going to get estimates between 60 and 65% of the population is Shia. So you do the math. The Shia have at least 20 million to 23, 24 million. The rest are Kurds, Christians, and other minorities. And a number of commentators, and even Biden, but when he said it, I really don't think he understood what he was saying, have said one solution is to divide up Iraq into really three countries. That'll never happen, but I think 4 is a possibility. Now, why do I say 4? Well, like I said, certain areas you have overwhelmingly are Shia or Sunni or Kurds. But in the larger cities, including Baghdad, it's very much mixed. So you could divide up the country with the Shia controlling southern and eastern Iraq. And remember, the eastern portion borders on Iran, which is also Shia. Northeastern would be the Kurds, and the north and east, and excuse me, west would be Sunni, and Baghdad would be mixed, as well as a couple of other cities. And what I'm giving you this background for a reason. The Sunnis and Shia are different religious sects or branches of Islam. They don't get along. They've never get along. And you got to understand why Sunnis predominate in terms of, there are about 1.4 billion people of the Islamic faith, Muslims, across the world, not just in the Middle East and not just in Iran, of which about 89%, the majority are Sunni, and 10 to 11% are Shia. And there's some other sects, but those are the major two. You've had a long history of bad blood between both branches. Now, when Saddam Hussein was in power, he more or less kept the lid on it, but he was Sunni. And you need to understand this. Sunnis, although a minority in the past in Iraq, have really ruled Iraq, whether it was under Saddam Hussein or previous rulers, whether kings or despots. So there's a lot of antipathy, bad blood between both groups. And the one thing they don't like to mention, but it's becoming more and more clear, Iraq today is a failed state. It is in civil war. And civil, what I mean by a civil war, it's a civil war between the Sunnis and the Shia. And occasionally the Kurds get involved when they feel threatened, for example, by the Islamic State. So we have a nation that's in civil war. The Iraq government, the Iraq army, really has not been able to control and contain the Islamic State. And what the Islamic State wants to do is to establish, and they've already declared, a caliphate ruled by a caliph, and it's the leader of the Islamic State. And where the area under their control initially would be Iraq and Syria, but ultimately they would like to control Lebanon and Jordan and Israel. The latter is, as far as I'm concerned, forget about it. You're never going to have a chance to do that. But that's what they're about. They want to establish their own country, the Islamic State, mainly in Iraq and Syria, under Sharia law. They're Sunnis, and it's a very fundamentalist version of Sharia law, a rather severe version of Sharia law. So that's the background, and you need to understand that, because I'm puzzled, as well as people in the press, what is the reluctance or apparent reluctance of this administration not to call it a war? It's obviously a war. The American people feel we're at war with the Islamic State. Now, I want to make it official in this sense. I think the Islamic State needs to be destroyed. It needs to be destroyed. But the question is how and by who and what. And what should be the United States' role, if any? I think whether or not the United States should lead a coalition and be highly active militarily in this coalition should be the subject of debate in Congress. In other words, there should be a declaration of war against the Islamic State. Here's the problem. It is certainly not clear to me whether a declaration of war, if all the issues were, or a lot of the issues involved with that were fully explored, whether it would pass in Congress, in the House and the Senate. And it really should be done before the election. But because we have an election, that's just another reason why it won't be done at all. Neither Republicans or Democrats would want to vote on a declaration of war. You see, the only Congress can declare war, and that's the important point. And that's really why, one of the reasons why this administration doesn't want to call it a war. Because if you call it a war, then you, if you follow the Constitution, you need to go to Congress and ask the Congress for a declaration of war. That's why they're sensitive in playing these word games. I call it lawyer weasel words, because that's what they are. For anyone with an ounce of common sense And that's the problem. A lot of these people lack common sense, would say we're at war with the Islamic State. We've had over 180 airstrikes, both by drones and fighter jets. I'm sure the ones that are on the receiving end of the sharp spear, in other words, they got a missile up you know what, think they're at war with the United States. And I'm sure the pilots, whether they're in fighter jets or piloting these drones, believe they're at war because they're dropping deadly missiles and bombs on the Islamic State. They're killing people. So by anyone's definition, this is war. It's not a sustained counterterrorism operation or campaign. It's war. Whether you like it or not, whether you favor war or not, it's war. And see, that's where I think the American people are owed honesty. I think this is being, the word would be disingenuous. I think this is really misleading and lying to the American people. We're at war. And make no mistake about it. People are dying. And people are, and American soldiers and airmen, pilots, are risking their lives. Because, I say that, because the Islamic State has shoulder-mounted surface-to-air missiles that can bring down helicopters, jets, airliners. Keep that in mind, because I'm going to talk about that a little bit later in the show and relate it to what happened on September 11th, 2012, where our ambassador in Benghazi was killed, as well as three other Americans. And why were they there? As a matter of fact, let me get into that now, because it's important. Because we just celebrated the anniversary of not only September 11th, 2001, but also the anniversary of September 11th, 2012. We're going to have a congressional special, well, not special, a select committee investigating what happened in Benghazi. And it should be starting, well, within the next 90 days. It might have already started. I know they're trying to get a staff and hire investigative staff as well as some attorneys that have that have been prosecutors, and to really get to the bottom of Benghazi as to why it happened. I am not sure they're ever going to get to the bottom of it, and why do I say that? And this is very important because it ultimately is directly linked to the Islamic State as well as the other al-Qaeda groups that are in Syria fighting the Assad regime. Why was the Central Intelligence Agency in Benghazi? That, and what were they doing? Why were they there and what were they doing? And what do we know from, there have been a number of press accounts. The CIA initially went into Libya to supply the Libyan rebels, not the Syrian rebels, not the Iraqi rebels, but the Libyan rebels, with arms, training, intelligence, as well as how to coordinate airstrikes to overthrow the Gaddafi regime. Now, you need to understand that Russia was willing to let the United States use fighter aircraft to defend against, well, let me back up. They didn't want Gaddafi overthrown. That was Russia's position. And it voted for the resolution in the UN that allowed the NATO forces, including the United States, to use force in Libya. But the gentleman's agreement was this would not lead to the overthrow of Gaddafi. They felt and have since that they were double-crossed by the United States because the Gaddafi regime fell. As a direct result of the United States through the CIA, as well as aircraft from our allies, as well as U.S. aircraft, aiding and abetting the Benghazi rebels to overthrow Gaddafi. They were successful. Mission accomplished, they were successful. But what happened? And why was Benghazi important? Benghazi is where many of al-Qaeda were based. As a matter of fact, where many of the recruits that went into Afghanistan to fight the Soviet Union and now the United States in Afghanistan came from. It's a hotbed of al-Qaeda and radical fanatic Islam. And that's what Gaddafi was, a secular leader, a dictator, not a nice guy. I'm glad he's gone. But what do we have in his place? Something that's a lot worse. We have chaos. We have instability. We have a number of rebel groups fighting each another. Sound familiar? It sounds very much like Iraq and Syria. So the CIA initially was there to train these rebels and give them arms and tell them how to coordinate with our aircraft as well as be on the ground to You need ground observers to tell the aircraft who to attack. Usually that's either U.S. or British, French special operators providing instructions and communicating with our aircraft above as to who to attack. Well, they were successful. Then we had what I would call mission creep. We had a CIA station chief as well as a station, not only in Tripoli, but also in Benghazi. And they stayed there. Why did they stay there? Why did they stay there? In other words, why were there 35 people in Benghazi, security people, CIA agents, as well as CIA employees? What were they doing? What was the CIA annex for? Yes, they were gathering intelligence, but the main reason they were there was to accumulate or aggregate weapons that Gaddafi had. And remember, Gaddafi was in power over 40 years. He had numerous bases, Army, Air Force, Navy, across the country. And at those bases, they had arms, pistols, rifles, rocket-propelled grenades, shoulder-mounted surface-to-air missiles that could bring down aircraft, such as helicopters, fighters, transports, and airlines. They were scattered over the country. So when Gaddafi fell, most, if not all, of these depots, lockers, warehouses were broken into. And these very various rebel groups, most of them, not all of them, but most of them Al-Qaeda linked or affiliated, armed themselves. They armed themselves to the teeth. They carried these away. And there was a lot of them, because after 40 years of being in power, getting trillions of dollars in petrodollars from selling oil, Gaddafi had a lot of arms. And the only reason he really fell was the fact that the United States and NATO brought in air power to suppress Gaddafi's own forces. In other words, we took sides in a civil war with the Libyan rebels. Unfortunately, we found out after the fact, actually I think we knew before the fact, that many of these rebels don't like the United States. Yeah, they're going to take our money, they're going to take our arms, they're going to take our help to overthrow Gaddafi, because they weren't able to do that in over 40 years. But they want to replace it with a government that's ruled by Sharia law. You see, there's a common denominator running through all this. You have extremist militants of the Sunni persuasion that don't want a modern secular government at all. And given the failures of those secular governments that were mainly socialist, I can understand their animus against Gaddafi and others through the Middle East. But the problem, ladies and gentlemen, why they don't like and want to overthrow their dictators or tyrants or kings, they don't particularly care for the United States either. They'll take our money, they'll take our arms, they'll take our assistance. But once the civil war is over and the insurgency is won, they tend to turn on the very people that have helped them. And that's exactly what happened. Now, why did the CIA stay there after Gaddafi fell? Why was Ambassador Stevens there? He was there to organize the shipment of arms and fighters, but mainly arms, from Libya to Turkey and through Turkey to Syria to arm the so-called Free Syrian Army, the FSA, the Free Syrian Army. That was the original plan. Now, you need to understand, for the CIA to be doing this, the president had to sign a secret finding directing the CIA to conduct this operation. And he also had to notify Congress, 8 people in Congress, to do this. The leadership of both the Republicans and the Democrats in the Senate and the House. In other words, the House Speaker and House Minority Leader needed to be informed, as did the Senate Majority Leader and Minority Leader need to be informed. That's 4 people. And then the Chairman and the Ranking Minority Leader of both the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee needed to be informed. In other words, in this instance, 4 Republicans and 4 Democrats, both in the Senate and 4 in the House, 4 in the Senate, total of 8, were informed what the president was doing. That's what was happening in Benghazi. That's why the ambassador, the very day he was killed, his last meeting was with a Turkish diplomat to arrange these shipments. And they were going to where? to Turkey, either on ship or plane, and then through Turkey to Syria, ultimately the Syrian rebels. Now, what's the problem? And why was the CIA annex, as well as the so-called diplomatic facility where the ambassador was, why was it attacked? Initially, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United States were conducting this covert operation. And what happened is, over time, it became increasingly clear that the so-called rebels in Syria were largely Sunni religious fanatics. Many of them, not all of them, but many of them were al-Qaeda affiliates, including Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic, what today is called the Islamic State. It has since come out that upwards of 95% of the so-called Syrian rebels, they're all religious fanatics. They're not all al-Qaeda, but it doesn't matter what the name is. None of them call themselves al-Qaeda. That's just to confuse you. But the United States initially had agreed to get involved through its intelligence agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, combined and together with the Saudi Intelligence Agency, Turkish, as well as Qatar's. Some would supply the money to buy the weapons. Some would supply the weapons. We would provide intelligence to the extent that we had it. But we had a lot of weapons in Libya. And we had a lot of money buying those weapons from the rebels to ship ultimately to the Syrian rebels, who were, what was their main objective? To overthrow the Bashar Assad regime in Syria. The objective was to overthrow the Syrian government. And I don't care for Assad either. There's a lot of bad actors here. That's the problem. There are no good choices here. And there are a lot of people that will take our money and take our arms and say they got an army behind them when all they are is a front. And that's one of the traps that our Central Intelligence Agency, and one of the things they have to worry about, are the people they're dealing with. Whose side are they really on, and do they really have a military force that can take on the Assad regime, which is not easy? They are well-armed, and their supporters are Russia, who's providing arms, including anti-aircraft missiles, very sophisticated missiles, and they have fighter jets and helicopters, but also Hezbollah, which is funded by Iran, and Iran is funding and shipping military equipment to Hezbollah through Syria, or at least was. So you need to understand who are the players here and what are they about. The United States wants to overthrow Assad. They were successful overthrowing Gaddafi. They were successful overthrowing Saddam Hussein. They were successful in getting one of our allies, Egypt, Mubarak, out and putting in, listen to this, the Muslim Brotherhood, radicals. I should be fair to them. On paper, they're like a community organization, do a lot of social work, professionals join. But they have a military wing, and once they got power, once they had the election, they started killing their enemies. And the army said enough is enough and stopped it. And now most of those leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood are in jail facing a sentence of a death penalty and will be executed. And Obama supported the Muslim Brotherhood, and they are radicals. They are an exclusive totalitarian organization or movement that the Egyptian people, the majority of the Egyptian people, as well as the military, don't like. Egypt is a basket case economically and has relied on the United States for military equipment for many years until recently. So the United States had a conscious policy of destabilizing the Middle East, totally destabilizing the Middle East, and replacing current regimes with a figurehead or a person that we could support that's, in essence, more reliable. This is not new, folks. And the CIA has always been involved, and presidents, both Republican and Democrat, are guilty of using the Central Intelligence Agency to do these so-called covert operations. Now, what's the problem? A little over 2 years ago, our diplomatic facility in Benghazi. Remember, the capital of Libya is Tripoli. That's where our embassy is. We had, and we're in the process of establishing a consul office in Benghazi. But that was attacked. Forget what you call it. It was a compound with a number of buildings. It was attacked, and I'll give a plug. Fox News recently had an interesting report, 13 Hours of Benghazi, which I recommend that you go to YouTube and listen to and watch. It gives you some of the details of the people that were actually there. Now, I didn't get into the threshold question. Why was the Central Intelligence Agency there? Well, I've told you the answer. They were tasked through a secret presidential finding that Congress was notified of what he was doing, had to by law, that the United States was shipping weapons, armaments, supplies, and fighters to, and providing intelligence to, the so-called Free Syrian Army, the rebels in Syria, with the express purpose of overthrowing the Assad regime. And we were doing that in conjunction with several foreign intelligence agencies, including those in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. Initially, Qatar was taking the lead on this, providing the money. Saudi Arabia has subsequently taken that over. And Turkey is, although in NATO and an ally, has a problem right now. The Islamic State has in its hands several dozen Turkish diplomats and their people that were there that were captured in Mosul. And they're afraid if they really do support the United States in its efforts in the to try to degrade and destroy the Islamic State, that their hostages would be killed. So they're somewhat backing off their previous support. They were, in essence, a middleman facilitating the shipment of arms as well as money and personnel through Turkey into Syria to overthrow the Assad regime. Ladies and gentlemen, that's what was going on, and that's what the president doesn't want out. And it remains to be seen whether our House Select Committee is really going to investigate this and air this in public. See, that's a $64,000 question as far as I'm concerned. There's a lot to Benghazi, but the essence of Benghazi, and this needs to be answered, why was the Central Intelligence Agency there? What were they doing? They weren't having a picnic. It wasn't a training conference. It wasn't a tourist vacation to see the sights of Benghazi. Benghazi is a very, very dangerous place for Europeans, Americans, and very importantly, Central Intelligence agents or their employees, as not to mention our diplomatic personnel. And you saw what happened. They were attacked. They were attacked by another al-Qaeda-related group, and this time in Libya. And they killed four of our people and wounded several others very seriously. Now, why were they attacked if we were providing these arms to the Syrian rebels? Well, initially we were. We were doing that. There had been shipments. But then the covert operation was blown wide open. Why was it blown wide open? Why did al-Qaeda attack? Because the president got cold feet. He stopped the shipments. And in retaliation, al-Qaeda struck in Libya. And four U.S. government, State Department, Central Intelligence Agencies, employees, a total of four, were killed. You see, there's always the temptation for any president to use the Central Intelligence Agency, hoping and thinking it never will see the light of day. We can do these dirty deeds. Isn't it neat? We got Gaddafi, now we'll get Assad. We're on a roll. Iran's next. Let's destabilize the Middle East, put our people in, spend a lot of money, give them equipment, and ultimately win the war with Iran. Sounds good, but there's always a price, and the bad guys don't roll over and play dead. They're deadly serious. Their back is to the wall, and they're going to react. They're not going to wait for us to attack and say, "Here I am, fire your missile." And they have allies in Russia because they felt double-crossed by President Obama, in terms of what happened to the Gaddafi, were not going to let it happen in Syria, and neither was Iran. And that's why, ultimately, even after drawing half a dozen red lines, the president backed off. And one consequence, not a bad consequence, some of those chemical weapons, over time, are being destroyed. It's going to take time, though. And I don't think we're ever going to know, and I seriously doubt that we have them all. So that's one positive. I'll give some credit for President Obama, but that was a Russian proposal to really get President Obama off the hook. He was embarrassed. Keep drawing red lines and not doing anything. In other words, you got to put up or shut up. Trying to bluff your way is not a good idea when the other guy knows you're bluffing and has some big supporters. And that's exactly what Assad has. Assad is not liked in Syria, by the way. And no one's going to cry if the Assad family is replaced by someone else. But here's the problem. Assad regime looks very good compared to the Islamic State. Very good. Because what has the Assad regime done that the Islamic State has not? The Assad regime has protected Christians. The Islamic State has killed Christians throughout Iraq, as well as other religious minorities. You see, the Sunnis, especially the fundamentalists or the militants, or if you I prefer the word jihadists, of the lesser or violent jihad, there are different interpretations of what the word jihad means. The literal interpretation is struggle, but you can have an inner struggle where you struggle to be an ethical, moral person. And there's the violent or lesser jihad where you defend your country or where the Islamic faith is practiced against invasion from foreign forces, including the United States, by the way. And that's what the Islamic State is all about. That's why when the president really lied to the American people saying the Islamic State is neither Islamic nor a state, I looked at him and said, I can't believe you said that. Yeah, I want the Islamic State to be destroyed. My only argument is how you go about it and who does it. But tell the American people honestly what these people are about. And that's what he doesn't want to do. Why? Who are his allies? And what's the coalition he's trying to come up with? And that'll be the subject of the next show. It's the Sunnis, but it's not. Sunni is a major branch of Islam. It's the majority branch by far. But in Saudi Arabia, you have the Wahhabi sect. And they are very ultra-conservative, puritanical, want Sharia law to be the law of the land, do not practice in any way religious toleration. And they're the ones that want the Sunnis, rebels, in Iraq and Syria armed to do what? To kill the Shia minorities there. You see, it's a religious sectarian war that's going on, both in Iraq and in Syria. What's a little different about Syria is Assad's family is Alawite, but it's a sort of a version of being Shia, but they are supported by the Shias. You see, the Arab nations, especially the monarchs, the royal family of Saudi Arabia, supports this Wahhabi sect. They're in bed with them, and it's to control their people. It's a very repressive regime, very wealthy. Especially if you're a prince or work for the Saudi regime, and there are several million foreigners, United States citizens, Europeans, Great Britons, working for them, for Aramco and other companies there, and they have their enclaves. But in terms of their people, the royal family has been corrupt. They've been raking in billions, trillions of dollars, and they've spent most of it, or a good chunk of it, I shouldn't say most of it, a good chunk of it on military arms. And where are they buying those arms? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the United States and Great Britain. You see, there is interest involved here. We have large defense contractors that have large contracts with, in the past and continuing into the future, with the Saudis to supply arms. F-15s, for example. So the Saudis, because they have the petrodollars, need to recycle them. And part of what they do is they make sure they have a strong military, Air Force, Army, because they have enemies. Who do they most fear? Who is the one nation they most fear and really hate? It's Iran, the Persians or Iranians. And they hate them not only for being Iranians or Persians, but for being Shia. They consider Shia an infidel. They consider Christians, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, as well as Shia, infidels. We don't believe in Islam, their brand of the Islamic faith. Now, they're not killing us in terms of Christians, Europeans in Saudi Arabia, at least not yet, but they are an extreme radical branch of Islam. There's no doubts about that. And I could give you a long discussion of the origins of Wahhabism, but to keep it real simple, they're Sunnis and they're an extreme branch of Islam. They want Sharia law And they want it enforced. They have a religious police or virtue police, whatever they call it, going around making sure that no one's breaking Sharia law. It's a very repressive regime. Now, why are they our allies? Ladies and gentlemen, that is the important question. It's oil. The only reason the United States has been in the Middle East, and the same goes for Great Britain and France and Russia, is oil. Oil and natural gas. It's oil. You need to follow the money, and you need to understand what's going on. President Obama doesn't want to say there's a war going on. This is terrorism. But who funded the terrorism? What's going on? Why did the Syrian rebels suddenly grow so successful and powerful? It was because of money, weapons supplied by Qatar, the United Arab Emirates to some extent, but mainly Saudi Arabia through Turkey. And the U.S. government instigated this and went along with this up to a point. And when they got cold feet, our people, U.S. citizens, were killed in Benghazi. That's the story they don't want to come out. They don't want the American people to know that. Now, there are many people that know this. I'm not the only one that knows this. There have been a lot of reports on this. The problem is the United States government does not want to confirm it was doing this. And why? Because I'll tell you something. It was against the law, federal law, to support in any way terrorists. In other words, the actions that the Central Intelligence Agency was engaged in at the orders of the President of the United States broke federal statutes that it's a crime to in any way support terrorists, and that's exactly who the Syrian rebels are, and we're seeing the ultimate consequences of that support. Yes, we shut it off and are now turning it back on. You know, we did it secretly when Benghazi broke, and actually somewhat before that, we turned it off, and now we turned it on. We built the Islamic State. We built al-Nusra and the other rebel organizations with the help and the assistance of other foreign intelligence agencies and governments and citizens. We built this monster. We thought we could control the monster, and the monster has gotten out and is now killing Europeans and American journalists. And they're probably going to kill more because they're religious fanatics. Just like the Wahhabis, they think Christians, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, and especially Shia are apostates. They're infidels, and they should be killed. And that's what they do if you fall into their hands. They'll try to ransom you first. So the reason why President Obama and his underlings, Susan Rice and Kerry, don't want to call it a war is because they don't want to go to Congress and ask for a declaration of war. Because in asking for a declaration of war, a lot of things have to be aired. And one of the questions that's going to be asked, who funded al-Nusra, the Islamic State, and other rebel organizations in Syria and now in Iraq? And the answer, ladies and gentlemen, is the United States government, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar with the assistance of Turkey. That's the dirty little secret that the White House doesn't want out. That's the scandal that needs to be investigated. That is what the Select Committee in the House needs to look into if they have the courage and fortitude to do it. And I think the president thinks by attacking the Islamic State, a lot of this can be swept under the rug. Well, I'm not letting it be swept under the rug, because the people that now that are killing Americans were aided and abetted by the United States and its so-called allies in the Middle East. And they're creating a unstable situation throughout the Middle East, primarily directed at Shia Muslims in Iran and Russia. This is more, I don't like the phrase, but it is a dangerous game they're playing, and it can lead to a regional war and a world war. Because Russia and Iran, and to a certain extent China, are not going to lay down and play dead. They're not. And they've seen Obama's double dealing in Libya. So this could quickly develop into a full-scale conventional war and even possibility of a nuclear war. This is dangerous, folks. This is a reason you should have declarations of war, so the American people know beforehand what's going on. Why are we there? And the only reason why we're there is oil. Oil is the only reason. That's the so-called national interest in Iraq. Because after Saudi Arabia and Iran act in terms of the Middle East countries, they're the, and Kuwait. Iraq is a big player, and with U.S. investment by U.S. oil companies, as well as British and European oil companies, Iraq could be producing 2 to 3 times its current production of over 3 million barrels a day. In other words, within 3 to 5 years, it could be at 6 million barrels, and in 10 years, upwards of 10 million barrels. They have that much oil there. What they don't have is the technology, the investment, and the know-how to really develop it. And that's why they need the European and U.S. oil companies and oil field service companies. It's all about oil, and it has been all about oil for over 100 years. And I need to say this because I forgot to say it early in the show. The way you listen to the Pronk Pop show is go to pronkpops.wordpress.com. That's pronkpops.wordpress.com. And at the very top, you'll have links to my most recent 60 to 80 shows. And at the very bottom, all my shows except some of the earlier ones that we accidentally overwritten. But in between, and this is the point I was trying to make, I have a lot of videos, a lot of background. I know you all don't have time to look at it, but I'm giving you a lot of background about the history of oil in the Middle East. And the reason why oil is important, no industrial economy can run without energy. And the principal energy for motor vehicles as well as fighting vehicles, tanks, armored personnel carriers, you need diesel and gasoline. As well as our aircraft, and as well as our Navy ships. And Great Britain understood that, and that's why initially they were heavily involved in Iraq and what is today Saudi Arabia. You see, there's a long history of European powers, principally Great Britain, France, initially Russia, when it was an empire under the Tsars, of being involved in the Middle East primarily to get oil. Remember, the Middle East was a very, very, very poor area in terms of just the economy. Many of them, they were just Bedouins. They were dirt poor. It's only oil and the discovery of oil and the development of those oil wells over decades that made them very rich, and now the people of that country want to control it, as well as the large oil companies that want to have control over the price of oil. Ladies and gentlemen, this is very important to a lot of companies. Our defense contractors, as well as the oil companies, as well as our financial institutions, investment banks. This is big business. This is about power, money, but the one reason we're in the Middle East, the one reason I'm talking about this today is because of oil. Because without oil, the United States could care less as to what's happening in Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Iraq. And so would the American people. It's only oil that has resulted in the wars in the Middle East. Always keep that in mind and always follow the money, because it's money that's driving this. Big money is driving this. And I'm all for free enterprise and companies making money. Don't get the wrong impression. But let's be honest as to what's going on in the Middle East. The American people demand honesty, and they're not getting it. They're being lied to, they're being misled, and they're playing games we're not at war with them, that these are terrorists. Listen, depending on your point of view, everybody's a terrorist, because when the bullets start flying, it's terrifying for both parties. And what we're staring in the face is a potential regional civil war between the Sunnis and the Shia. This could easily get out of hand. And that's why I'm very much disturbed, because I listen to a lot of talk radio and I'm amazed what some of the talk show hosts are talking about. We have more concern about what's happening in the National Football League instead of war and peace and how it could affect the entire world. Remember, football is a game, folks. It's a business and it's a game. But this could affect every American, both economically. And if you have a son and daughter that volunteers, they might be there. In our next show, I'll talk about the coalition that the President and Secretary of Kerry is building, as well as who supplied the money and arms, which I sort of touched on here, to these organizations, and what really needs to be done. We'll be right back. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College.